Are you tired of hearing the same stories of true crime, weird history, and the paranormal?
Now dubbed the Night Stalker, the crime spree covers 50 miles. The suspect varies the time, place, and type of attack.
Watching John Gacy's suburban Chicago home for the past 10 days. They became suspicious when 15-year-old...
In Miami, Judge Edward Cowart is expected to rule today on two defense motions in the trial of Theodore Bundy. He's accused of murdering two co-eds at Florida.
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, a postal worker, walked out of his Yonkers apartment last night.
Fan claims he spotted Bigfoot.
The next guest may have taken one of the best ever pictures of the Loch Ness
Channel
Monster.
Channel 10 News and the police department have been flooded with phone calls from people reporting UFO sightings.
Don't worry, you're not alone.
Hi, welcome to the Macabre Emporium.
Gertrude's daughter even got to join in on what they considered fun.
Tell us about the giant turtle.
Alan never showed up, nor was he ever heard from again beyond that point.
For approximately 10 days, Helmut Winters would lob potato dumplings at aircraft flying over his house. And one of Helen's experiences would come one winter night while looking out a window facing the Hudson River.
Each week, we will bring you a lesser-known story of true crime, weird history, or the paranormal. So come on in and browse the shelves of the Macabre Emporium. You never know what you'll find here.
Hey guys, my name is Casey.
And I'm Daniel.
And we're a married couple who recently started a true crime podcast called Dancy True Crime. That's D-A-N-S-I, True Crime.
I enjoy myself some true crime, so we hope you do too. Come on over and check us out.
We can't wait to see you guys there.
We take turns on who tells the story every week. Our episodes are posted every Monday at 12 p.m. Central Standard Time.
To subscribe or follow, check us out on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Pandora, and Stitcher.
Oh, don't worry, guys. We have a couple other places here. We are also available on Facebook, TikTok, and the Instagram.
Our podcast is for mature audiences only. See you guys soon. Bye.
Bye.
Hey guys, I just want to remind you to follow our Facebook page, join our group. It is Dancy True Crime. That is D-A-N-S-I, True Crime. And also, you can hear us on Anchor or Spotify. Please rate us and subscribe or follow and share our episodes. Message us on Facebook. Let us know what you think, what we could change, what we could do better. Do you have anything you want to add, babe?
No, I think you did it. You said it just perfect, so.
All right. Well, we hope you guys have a fantastic week and that you enjoy today's episode.
We'll see you next week, guys.
Bye. Warning, the following is intended for mature audiences only. Viewer discretion is advised. Hey guys, Casey here. I just wanted to remind you that if you want to see our research links or photos that we have, they will be posted on our Facebook page. They are posted at the same time as our podcast on Anchor and Spotify. That is every Monday at 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. So we hope to see you guys there.
Hey guys, I'm Casey.
And I'm Daniel. And today we've actually got some special guests. We have David and
Sarah
from the Macabre Emporium. And they are joining us for this week's case on Howard Unruh. So guys, how's it going this morning for you?
Oh yeah, it wouldn't be morning now actually for us now that it's 3 minutes past midnight now as we're starting this recording here.
Yes. We kind of actually met David and Sarah through, it was actually Casey. She kind of ran across them, and you kind of want to tell them how we met?
Well, it was them that messaged me first because they gave us a shout out on their podcast.
Yeah. So, and once again.
Well, they messaged our page, but yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, once again, guys, thank you very much for that shout out. That was very awesome.
Oh, you're welcome. I mean, if I remember how it was when we first started, I know that it hasn't much of time difference between when you guys started and we get. And we have started, and then it was like, I've had a few friends that have their own shows do the same thing, so I basically, you know, passed it forward to other people as well.
Awesome.
Most definitely. And then it's pretty cool, too, because, of course, we got those mutual friends of over at Dark Windows, so
yeah.
We've always got to give them a shout-out for the Kevin, so.
Yeah, that's how I found out was that small promo trailer, that episode, if you would want to call it, that Kevin had did. And he had put you guys in there.
Yeah. Oh, very nice. Yeah, it's us, them, and I think one other podcast that's on there.
Could have been, but I didn't remember the name of it off the top of my head.
I don't either.
Doesn't matter.
I just heard it again the other day.
But anyway, so, well, all right, guys. Well, we'll go ahead and just jump right on in to this. So for this week, we are talking about Howard Unruh. It was actually interesting. The more research I was doing on this, this is actually recorded from the Smithsonian Magazine as the very first mass shooting in U.S. history. According to Wikipedia, a mass shooting is a crime in which an attacker kills or injures multiple individuals simultaneously using a firearm. Because at first I was like, okay, is this going to be considered like a serial killing or what exactly? So I needed to look a little bit more into that. So to start things off, here's a little bit of the background on Howard and how he became the first mass shooter in U.S. history. He was born on January 20th of 1921 to Sam and Ferda, which sometimes she is referred to as Rita. Unfortunately, they would actually separate when Howard was a boy. Him and his brother Jim was raised in Camden by their mother, who was actually a worker in a local soap company in Evanston. So at the age of 28, in October 1949, so it is a psychiatric report that had declared him insane.
So you're saying he's a certified wackadoodle?
Yes. Yes, he was. Now, it was also noted that Unruh had a rather prolonged period of toilet training and did not walk or talk until he was 16 months old.
You know, that's funny because Benton didn't walk or talk until the day before he turned 16 months old.
Oh, goodness. But now, otherwise, he was basically an average, unamusing kid. He was vicious. He regularly read the Bible and attended services at the St. Paul's Evangelical Lutheran Church. And he was also shy, kept to himself. And his two favorite hobbies was actually, he liked to collect stamps and even build model trains. And that's definitely something you don't see much these days.
Right.
Yeah, those model train people are fucking weirdos. I don't know what you're talking about on that one.
David's one of those.
Oh, I apologize, David.
That's all right.
And I think I remember you talking about that in one of your earlier episodes, actually.
I probably did. And then she's probably brought, I know she has brought it up in a more recent one about, I don't remember which one it was now.
About what, though?
About the model train stuff.
Outside of that, he actually was not a drinker or smoker, even as an adult. Now, the yearbook from the Woodrow Wilson noted that his ambition was to work for the government, and fellow students actually called him Hal for short. Howard would later on be in actually World War II. Now, between high school and World War II, though, Unruh would work a series of blue-collar jobs, which he picked up for a spell after returning from Europe. Here are a few things that are said that he did. He worked at a printing outfit, the Acorn Company. He also operated a metal stamping press at Bud Manufacturing, but neither job lasted a year. He would also enroll in pharmaceutical school at Temple University, but this only lasted a few months as he dropped out. Yeah. And that's, I've been seeing a trend here with a lot of the murders, the killers that we've been covering. They'll either drop out in junior high or they'll drop out just a few months after college.
Yeah.
So I don't know for you guys if you've kind of noticed that trend just yet or anything.
I haven't, I don't think.
I haven't. And like with some of the ones that I've covered, it was like the most recent one, the Candyman, he wasn't able to maintain a stable work history for the most part.
Okay. Now, in December of 1948, this would come around, and Howard was unemployed and living full-time with his mother back in Kramer Hill. He ventured out into the neighborhood, but didn't have any friends he called upon. A psychiatrist would later write, quote, after World War II, after UNRWA returned home, he did not work, nor did he have any life goals or directions. He had difficulty adjusting to solving problems and was angry at the world, end quote. But so far, it's just seeming like from his childhood, it was a rough childhood. And
yeah.
He hates the world. This next section gets dark real fast. And here's going to be another trigger warning. And I'm not going to use some of the language because I don't agree with it. And I don't want to offend anybody. So, and we'll get to that here in just a little bit. As UNRWA's rage festered, in his mind, everyday ordinary happenings became acts of aggression that deemed retribution. He would begin to keep through a thorough list of his grievances and slights, both real and imagined. In the 1949 commitment report, UNRWA claimed that Mr. Cohen shortchanged him 5 times while Mrs. Cohen told him to turn down his music. The dulcet sounds of...
If it's too loud, you're too old.
Right, and it's... And we're talking,
I like my music.
Right, and we're talking...
It's like, damn it! I'm going to turn down that devil jazz music.
But here's the thing, though, because their son, his name was Charles, he was free to aggravate him with his trumpet. Now, while other neighbors on UNRWA's list included the man and the woman who lived below him and threw trash on his back lot, the barber who put dirt in a vacant yard that backed up the drainage and flooded his cellar, a shoemaker who buried trash close to his property, and a mystery boy named Sorg who taped his electricity to light up the Christmas tree.
Tapped.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry, I can't read. Who tapped his electricity to light up the Christmas trees as he was selling them on the street. UNRWA's paranoia about what was being said of him around Kramer Hill fueled his percussions complex. He was certain everyone was insulting him. He felt there was a number of people that knew he was a homosexual and they were talking about him. Said Mr. Cohen called him a queer, said the tailor and son.
I hate that word.
I know, and I apologize. And that's why I was saying earlier, it's with some of the stuff. And with that time, it's just one of those things. Now, the tailor and the son was spreading a story that, quote, he saw me go down on somebody in the alley one time, end quote, and was fearful for local teenagers who frequently harassed him and seen him at the family theater. Now, with UNRWA... was a gay man, he was upfront with the psychiatrist who interviewed him following the massacre. From 1944 through 1946, he did have a girlfriend, seemingly the only one in his life, but broke it off after telling her he was schizo. He would never marry her. He told the psychiatrist that she meant nothing to him, and that they never even had sex. Following their breakup, he had been with a lot of men, he said, and he'd once contracted gonorrhea.
Ouch.
Yeah. Now, after dropping out of the temple in 1948, he kept his room in a Philadelphia lodging house for nearly a year, saying that, quote, his interest in religion declined when his sexual relations with male friends increased, end quote. Ann Mitchell, an African-American maid who cleaned the rooms, told detectives investigating the massacre that she'd seen him going to and from his room to other men's rooms all the time, and added he would write
the N-word
in the dust and writing. He would write it on the walls and he would write it on the desk after returning from weekends in Camden. The report noted as Mitchell disliked him, she paid little attention to him, and she would never suspect him of anything. UNRWA paid his $30 a month on time from September 28th to 1948 until August 28th, 1949, and then never returned. So the sad irony is that one of the aspects of UNRWA that people did suspect being a homosexual was accurate. But he couldn't live as an open gay man, as in the era, it wasn't just socially unacceptable, but it was illegal. What most Cramer Hill people didn't suspect, even while finding him rather strange, was that he was a powder keg. Seymour Shubbin's article, quote, "Camden's One Man Massacre," end quote, which took up an entirely of the December 1949 issue of the Tragedy of the Month, Taylor Tom Zagrino, I apologize if that's not pronounced right, described a pre-shooting UNRWA as awfully polite, the kind of guy who wouldn't hurt a flea. His wife of less than a month, Helga, who would be one of UNRWA's last victims, added, quote, "I think he's a nice fellow. He seemed devoted to his mother, too. That's something I like," end quote. On Labor Day of 1949, Howard UNRWA decided to go to the movies. He left his Camden, New Jersey apartment and headed to the Family Theater in downtown Philadelphia. On the bill that night was a double feature, the double-crossing gangster movie, Cheated the Law and the Lady Gambles, in which Barbara Stanwyck plays a poker and dice game addict. UNRWA, however, wasn't interested in the pictures. He was supposed to meet up with a man whom he had been having a weeks-long affair with. Unfortunately for UNRWA, 28 years old at the time, traffic held him up, and by the time he reached the theater, a well-known gay guy pick up a shot on the Market Street, his date was gone. Am I having moments again?
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, that should be good. Okay. So, sorry. So, UNRWA sat in the dark until 2:20 a.m., bitterly stewing through a multiple on-screen loops of the movies. At 3 a.m., he arrived home in New Jersey to find that the newly constructed fence at the rear end of his backyard, the apartment he shared with his mother, had been tampered with. The gate was missing. So now, this was the final straw. For a couple years, UNRWA had been contemplating killing several. He had been contemplating on killing several of his neighbors over petty squabbles, perceived slights and names of the name calling, and all which fed into his psychosis, and secured it with two clips and 33 loose cartridges. Unable to sleep, he made yet another mental list of his intended targets. A group of local shopkeepers one would find in a 1950s children's book. A druggist, a shoemaker, a tailor, a restaurant owner, and eventually UNRWA dozed off. Now, a few hours go by, and in the morning of Tuesday, September 6th, UNRWA would embark on his, quote, "walk of death," end quote. Murdering 13 people and wounding three others in a 20-minute rampage before being hauled by the police after a dangerous firefight. Circles and local old-timers, UNRWA in his early chapters and the... All right, now coming up, hold on tight because he's going to be bat-talking his mama a little bit.
Oh no!
He's gonna be—he threatens his mama after she makes him breakfast, and then and then he goes on the walk of death.
She might have to go find Salem the emotional support kit for Sarah.
maybe. Just hours after returning from Philadelphia, UNRWA was awoken by his mother, who prepared him a breakfast of fried eggs and milk. That was very sweet of her.
Why not fried eggs and ham?
You know?
I mean, the milk would be good too, but...
Right. So. Now, after... Like, oh, go ahead, David.
Like here, have a rock in your stomach before you go and do on this murder spree. Yeah. Like, stomach full of milk and eggs? Wow.
Ugh.
The curdle.
Oh! Gonna turn into cottage cheese.
My daughter is in love with cottage cheese. She just finished off that one that we had.
Oh.
It's so good.
Now, not to try to put a wrench into things, after eating, Unruh went into the basement and retrieved a wrench. Now you may ask, what is he going to do with this? This is when he started to threaten his mom. He would raise it over his head and just started going after her. And she said, quote, "What do you want to do that for, Howard?" End quote. She asked him a few different times. She would later say that her son appeared to be transfixed. So he would kind of go after her a little bit, and she was able to get away. She runs out the door and just heads to neighbor, fearing, you know, that her son had reached the tipping point. A short while later, after hearing yes, go ahead.
So was this, like, threatening of the wrench, like, completely unprovoked then?
Yeah. Yeah, that was just it. He was at his wit's end with everybody, but... From what I gathered, though, it didn't seem like that his mom even did anything. That they were actually really close. He was noted as like a mama's boy. He did everything with his mom. So what exactly provoked that?
Well, he was schizophrenic, right?
Yes.
Maybe he had an episode.
That'll do it.
Yeah. It was just with everybody calling him gay and just the homosexual... comments, it just, he couldn't handle it anymore.
But like, why go after the one person that's like not being an asshole towards you?
Right. So I'm not sure. But later on, though, once she heard some gunfire, she got herself together, she ended up fainting, but she was able to get away. Now, after all this, he ended up walking into the shoemaker store, and without saying a word, he would shoot John Pilatrick, the 27-year-old cobbler who was on his list, and he shot him right in the chest. Pilatrick fell to the floor, still alive. So what does Unruh do? He fires another round right into Pilatrick's head. And there was a young boy that was actually nearby, and he ended up crouched in fear behind the counter. So at this point, he's only got the one victim. Unruh walked back out to the street and entered to the barber shop next door. Clark Hoover, 33, was cutting the hair of Orr Smith, who was 6, who sat atop a white carousel-style horse as his mother, Catherine, looked on. The barber tried...
Is this a relative of yours?
No, as far as I know, this is not a relative. I thought the same thing when I was listening to it, but I don't believe so. So the barber tried to protect the child, but Unruh killed the boy with a bullet to the head. Aww. Yeah, 6 years old. A second shot ended Hoover's life. Unruh ignored Catherine, who was 42, who carried Oris into the street screaming until a neighbor threw them both in the car and sped away to the hospital. The next day, the horrific scene was described by Camden Corps Post columnist Charlie Humes, quote, "People were peering through a big plate glass window looking at a hobby horse in a barbershop that was closed," end quote. At the base of the standard, which held the wooden horse in place, was another blotch of blood. The blood of another little boy just past 6 who was having his haircut in preparation for his first trip to school the next day. Back on River Road, Unruh shot at a boy in the window, but missed. He then fired into the tavern across the street owned by Frank Engel in a 1974 Carrier Post retro perspective. Engel said that Unruh had never come inside the bar, but he had seen him walk down the street, walking straight like he had a poker in his back, and the kids on the corner would make some remarks about him. Nobody was hit as Engel ran upstairs and grabbed his .38 caliber Luger Meanwhile, Unruh reloaded and headed into the drugstore to confront his primary targets, the Coens. And they were the ones that they didn't like the loud music.
Wow.
Yeah. This one really got me. An insurance man, James Hutton, 45, was coming out of the drugstore to see what the commotion was all about. He came face to face with Unruh, but didn't move quickly enough when the killer said, "Excuse me." Realizing his time free of police was growing short, Unruh shot Hutton, saying, "I fired on him once," then stepped over him and went into the store. He saw Maurice, 40, and his wife, Rose, 38, running up the stairs into their apartment. Rose hid in a closet and put son Charles, 12, in a separate one. But Unruh shot three times through the door before opening it and firing once more into her face. Walking across the apartment, he spotted Maurice's mother, Minnie, 63, trying to call the cops, and shot her multiple times. He followed Maurice onto the porch roof and shot him in the back, sending him to the pavement below. Maurice Cohen was dead on the sidewalk, but Unruh continued his rampage. Back on River Road he goes. He killed four motorists who found themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. He leaned into a car driven by Alvin Day, 24, a television repairman and World War II vet who slowed down to the corner where Hutton's body lay and fired. Following Day's murder, accounts vary, but most likely Unruh next walked out into the street to a car stopped at a red light and fired into the windshield. He instantly killed the driver, Helen Wilson, 38, and her mother, Emma Matlock, 68, and wounded Helen's son, John Wilson, 9, with a bullet through the neck. He returned to the same side of the street with the goal of claiming his final two victims. So now he's going to go into the tailor shop looking for Tom Zergano, but only found Helga, 28. She was on her knees begging for her life when Unruh shot her at close range. Next door, Thomas Hamilton, less than 2 weeks shy of his third birthday, was playing with curtains near his playpen and looked out the window. Unruh said that he mistook him for a moving shadow for one of the people he believed was dumping trash in his yard and shot through the window, striking Hamilton with a bullet to the head.
What a jerk.
All because he's just angry at the world and didn't know how to handle it. On his final step, after darting back onto the alleyway, Unruh broke into a home behind his apartment lot and wounded a mother and son, Madeline Harry, 36, and Armad, 16, before running out of ammo and retreating to his apartment. By now, sirens were wailing. In 20 minutes, Howard Unruh had killed 12 and severely wounded 4. The toll would rise to 13. John Wilson, the 9-year-old car passenger, later died at the hospital. His Kramer Hill neighborhood was rattled to the point where a detective on the scene would say years later that the mailman dropped his full bag on the sidewalk, quit his job, and never came back. Unruh returned to his apartment as the crowd of authorities and neighborhood civilians gathered. In 1949, mass shootings were basically unheard of, so there were no official police protocols. As neighbors milled about, more than 50 officers surrounded the two-story stucco building and began blasting away at the apartment with machine guns, shotguns, and pistols, and even threw some in the crowd. Estimated to be thousands of people were in the line of fire. How haphazard was police work back then? The magazine Weird NJ discovered that became of Unruh's Luger, Detective Ron Connolly, following typical 1940s procedures, secured it in his locker. Upon retrying, he brought it home, and it was recovered in the early 90s, returned to Camden County's prosecutor's office, and marked as evidence. During the onslaught, Philip P. Buxton, an enterprising assistant city editor at the Camden Evening Courier, looked up Unruh's number in the phone book. Ringing it up, and to his surprise, he had the shooter on his line. So he starts chatting away with UNRWA for a few minutes, and as the bullets keep pouring into the apartment, shattering window panes, so the editor, he asks, how many people had you killed? In which UNRWA replied, I don't know yet. I haven't counted them. But it looks like a pretty good score.
What the hell?
Yeah.
Well, it's... Hearing the last bits of it, it's like, first of all, how do you not turn in evidence? But it being a German Luger, it was, at this point, was very rare for it to be in the United States at this point. Right. So it could be that as they got older, it's like, maybe I should turn this in. And then it's like, in using Thompson's to like go all out on this building that he's in, that's a bit much. But like, as you said, mass shooters weren't a thing, so they didn't know how to handle this.
Right. And you got to feel bad for these policemen because, you know, they're just unloading their guns and probably scared for their lives too.
Yeah.
Right.
It is also said that Buxton followed up asking why he was killing people. UNRWA said he didn't know, but he had to go because a couple of friends are coming to get me. In the chaos, a couple of policemen climbed onto the roof, the same one Maurice Cohen plunged from, and lobbed a tear gas canister into UNRWA's apartment. Their first was a dud. How that happens is beyond me. But the second was stingingly effective. 5 minutes later, here comes UNRWA, called out that he was surrendering. He shouted he was leaving his gun on the desk and walked out the back door with his hands held high. He was patted down and cuffed as gawkers screamed for the mass murderer to be lynched right then and there. One for years cop deemed to know, what's the matter with you? You a psycho? UNRWA flatly replied, I am no psycho. I have a good mind. For the next couple of hours, UNRWA would be grilled in a Camden detective's office. He took full responsibility for the killings and supplied details in a detached clinical manner. During the interrogation, District Attorney Mitchell Cohen, no relation to the druggist, noticed a pool of blood under UNRWA's chair. At one point, late in the rampage, UNRWA was shot in the buttock or upper leg by Frank Engel.
Just said he was shot in the ass.
Yes.
As Forrest Gump, it's like, oh, something bit me.
Little boy deserved it, though. He deserved a lot more. Oh. UNRWA was rushed to Cooper Hospital, the same one as his victims, but surgeons were unable to remove the bullet. Good for them. Less than 24 hours after his arrest, he was transferred to the Vroom building for the chemically insane at Trenton Psychiatric Hospital voluntarily.
Vroom building?
The Vroom.
Is it like an institution on wheels?
Maybe.
Vroom.
Oh, goodness. Now, he would remain on the grounds for the next 60 years, so no, it doesn't go vroom vroom.
Oh, man.
I know, right?
That would have been funny.
Just kind of like a used sanatorium line, just be like, you can fit so many nut jobs inside this building.
Oh, man.
If anybody like finds my terrible jokes bad, and it's you know, a mechanism for us that we have for covering these such dark topics that we go over with all the research we have with the videos, the pictures we see.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it's no disrespect to the victims or anything. It's just natural reaction for us at this point.
That's right.
Yeah, you're good.
Nah. Now, a case number would also go long. The case number is 47077. UNRWA would never stand trial for the, quote, walk of death. We are going to move up now to September 7th. A team of psychiatrists examined UNRWA for weeks, trying to get an understanding of why he did what he did. Many of their findings weren't released until 2012 at the request of the Philadelphia Inquirer. He cold-bloodedly explained everything, listing the neighbors who had wronged him, and describing each murder with little emotion. He claimed to feel sorrow for the children he had killed, but the doctor's notes indicate he didn't seem remorseful. Unruh went so far as to say that, quote, murder is sin and I should get the chair, end quote. The full accuracy of Unruh's statements is unknowledgeable because on more than occasion, psychiatrists administered truth serum, aka
narcosynthesis.
Okay. So aka narcosynthesis, which was then considered useful. Scientists discredited it in the 50s because patients often melded fact and fantasy together. In 1963, the Supreme Court ruled truth serum confessions unconstitutional in Townsend versus Sane. It's impossible to know the veracity of the reports from UNRWA's sessions, such as the ones where he had told a doctor that he had been in bed with Frida, fondled his mother's breasts, and that, quote, their privates touched, unquote. However,
With who?
With his mother.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. However, a psychiatrist notes a, quote, personal history, unquote, cementation that Unruh's brother James said once the patient had made advances to him when they were sleeping together, which he, James, had vigorously resisted. So he tried to do stuff with his mom and his brother, apparently.
Gross. Oh, that's a new detail about Unruh I never heard of before, but, you know,
yeah.
I don't know how much you know about Edmund Kemper. It could be a lot worse with his situation and with things he did with his mother.
Right.
Where did you find that at?
This was actually straight from the Smithsonian Magazine. That's where I got the majority of this information. On October 20th, 1949, a Camden County judge signed a final order of commitment based on a diagnosis of dementia paradox, mixed taped with pronounced catatonic and paranoid coloring. In standard parlance, he was also declared a paranoid schizophrenic. Unruh was considered too mentally ill to stand trial, although the murderers indicted him, the indictment remained if ever he were cured, so the missing Luger could have been a vital evidence in the trial. Ramsland believes Unruh's initial diagnosis was wrong, and that day he would have been found legally sane. Let's hear. They just didn't know what else to do in those days. She says, back then, paranoid schizophrenia was kind of a trash can diagnosis. You could put anything in there. But in the criteria have tightened up since. Unruh didn't have command hallucinations or anything like that. The standard is, are you so floridly psychotic that you don't know what you're doing is wrong? You can be psychotic and still get convicted. I suspect that Unruh had a personality disorder, but it's clear he knew what he was doing was wrong and there were legal consequences. I always found it so odd that they just locked him away and forgot about him. 13 people were killed. Are you kidding? Now, this is a little bit interesting too. So, Unruh's father, Sam, was ordered to pay $15 a month for Howard's upkeep in Trenton. So you pretty much have to pay just to have your sibling or child in jail.
You have to pay?
Yeah, that's what I was gathering. Yeah, he had to pay $15 a month for the upkeep while he was in Trenton.
Huh. Well, this is a mental institution, correct? That he's...
Yes.
He's being in... Well, that's probably why, since it's a medical facility.
Okay.
And not, like, a state-run prison would be my assumption of why.
Okay.
Only 15?
Yeah. And basically, for the next six decades, Unruh vanished. Occasionally, something would come up. In 1964, Unruh wrote a petition to have his indictment dismissed on the grounds that he was insane at the time of the shootings. He withdrew it, and probably upon understanding that it would be only useful as a defense in a trial, which he did not want. Freda visited him until her death in 1985. But after that, Unruh didn't talk much. Over the years, he did take an art class, and in the 70s, had an unrequited crush on a much younger inmate. But for the most part, he kept up with his stamp collection and was known to mop the floors while muttering to himself. In 1991, a psychiatrist said Unruh had one friendship inside, but actually, it was, quote, a person who just keeps talking all the time. Mr. Unruh is a good listener, end quote. In 1993, Unruh was transferred to a less restrictive geriatric unit where he would live out his days and then finally die in October 19th, 2009 at the age of 88.
Damn.
And that is Howard Unruh, the first mass shooter in U.S. history.
I don't know how I've never heard that name before.
No, I'm surprised. Like I said this before, you've been more into true crime than I have.
Yeah, I've never heard that.
You listen to more about all the serial killers and whatnot, where I'm more interested in like
the history,
the very unique things. Ones like yeah. this.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, and I'm double checking, this one was actually suggested, by Kevin Carlton.
Yep.
So.
Oh, I heard a kitty.
Yeah, that's Ginger, or the cranky old lady of the Emporium.
She would probably get a
one. The other two rambunctious ones are asleep right now, charging their batteries for their midnight fight. Well, yeah, like 2 a.m. fight now at this time, actually, for us.
Gotta love it. But yeah, so that's what I got on good old Howard. 13 murders in 20 minutes and just killing a few innocent people and innocent kids.
A few.
Yeah.
13 innocent people.
He didn't like the way they were treating him. They messed up his lawn, added a fence.
We have a lot of interesting cases.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know that maybe that Howard and Unruh, was some kind of inspiration for the Michael Douglas movie Falling Down, just because of how that character is in that movie from start to finish, for the most part.
I haven't seen that movie.
Oh, you've never seen that? You need to watch it.
All right.
Because it's basically this, he's only known as Defense in the movie because of his license plate, and he's in LA traffic in the early 90s, and he just finally loses it and just leaves his car on the LA freeway to make his way home and does similar things to this, but doesn't go on a murderous rampage, but it's very reminiscent of that for myself.
That's kind of how I felt too, listening to it.
Tell us a little bit more about this game.
Okay, so this game is called Killers the Card Game. You get a stable of five an infamous killer, and you have to go around the table, everyone to guess their turn, where you have to collect a kill count of, if I remember correctly, is it 10, sir? Do you remember?
A kill count?
Yeah, of how many victims you have to collect to win?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, you have to draw a card, and it could be either a weapon or a victim, and then each one has a perk. So, for example, like there's a prostitute card, and if you pull Jack the Ripper, he gets a +1 on cards that are labeled as prostitutes. But there's also a police roll after everybody goes, where evidence can be found and collected, and after each killer gets 3 pieces of evidence, they can be arrested. So the objective is to be the last killer standing, or get a total count of 10 to win.
Yep. It's a lot of fun.
And the thing is, this game can be played between, what is it? The original that's over here.
Oh, I don't know.
I think it's like 2 to 4, but when you start adding all the expansions, the creator says it can go all the way up to 16 players.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Unfortunately, well, I don't know if to say unfortunately. Luckily, we've never had enough people around to play that game, and I'm sure that game would take forever.
Oh my god, yeah.
To play, having to go through 16 players on their police roll and then starting over from player one.
Oh my goodness. Well, it definitely sounds like it'd be a fun game, though.
Oh, it is. Yeah. We play it quite a bit. I bought one of the expansions for it. There's multiple other ones. The guy that creates it, Jeff Ingenhousky, its creator, he's coming out with even more games. He's got one based off haunted houses. He's got one that's based off of cryptids. The name of his company is called Scorpion Lair Games, if anybody's interested in looking into more of his games. But the game is called Killers The Card Game is the actual full title of it. So I know you also like having topics suggested for you, so I might have one that you guys could put on your wheel.
Okay.
That I know you guys spin. If you want to put on your spin or just take it as a suggestion now, it's a very unique case to my home state of Indiana, and this case had a very big impact nationwide on the insanity play.
Okay.
And even the more interesting thing is there was only 2 people really involved with it and no deaths.
What?
Yes. Okay. So the case I'm talking about is
Tony Kornitz. Hold on 1 second. I'm putting it in my spreadsheet here.
Okay.
Okay. And what's the case?
I figured that would be the reaction I would get after I tell you there's only 2 people involved and nobody dies. So the guy's name is Anthony Kornitz, K-R-I-S-T-I, oops, that's not correct. That is, it's, as much as I looked in, you think I would know how to spell his last name off the top of my head.
K-U-R-T-I-S-I-S.
It's all,
it's something like
it's
that.
It's a weird spelling. So his name is Tony Kornitz, or Anthony, and it's K-I-R-I-T-S-I-S. When you start looking into that one and everything that goes on with it, you're going to just be like, what?
Yeah, it's a crazy story, that one.
It was the first time I had to do a 2-part episode.
So he was an American kidnapper. He was born back in 1932 and died in 2005. Yeah, that's definitely going to be an interesting one.
It is very interesting.
Well, with all that being said, are we going to spin the wheel tonight, or how we...
Yeah, we got to spin the wheel.
Nicholas Sheely. Well, all right, guys. Well, I think that's everything we've got for this week. You have anything else, honey?
So, if you go to ReaperApparelCo.com and enter the discount code of Dancy True Crime, D-A-N-S-I True Crime, you'll get 10% off. Or if you click on our link in our link tree below, you will get 15% off. And then our other one is Just Strong with the discount code of CASH00410. And you get 10% off, and that's at JustStrong.com. And in fact, I'm wearing my Just Strong hoodie right now. It's one of my favorite hoodies. I love that hoodie.
With Daniel's enthusiasm there about explaining it, it was like very reminiscent of like Mel Brooks in Spaceballs when he's talking about the whole merchandising. We have Dansy True Crime the thermos, Dansy True Crime the lunchbox, Dansy True Crime the breakfast cereal.
That is a good movie. Have you ever seen that?
Which one?
Spaceballs. Rick Moranis and...
I think like once or twice when I lived with Brie, because it's like her all-time favorite movie.
We're going to have to watch it this weekend, maybe?
Maybe.
Maybe. Oh, that's a good one, David. So for the Macabre Emporium, tell us a little bit more about your guys' podcast. Where did you guys come up with the name and just like anything in general?
Like, what do you guys, like, tell our viewers what you guys talk about or whatever you want to say about your podcast?
So Macabre Emporium podcast kind of originally started off with me just going on a rambling facts about John Dillinger I had just recently learned from Justin Rimmel's show, Mysterious Circumstances. And Sarah was kind of blitz from having a couple Long Islands with her sister listening to me. And she was like, you know what, you really should start a podcast with all this information that you know. And I just kind of bounced back and forth with it and whatnot. And then I said something to her about, do you want to do this with me, or do you just want this to be a solo project? So, no, I'll do this with you. And then with the coming up with the ideas of how we want to do this, we wanted to do a true crime, but I also wanted to do like history things as well too. So, and where the name comes from, Macabre Emporium, is basically think of like Needful Things, Stephen King's Needful Things for the most part, is where that idea came from.
But for those that don't know what that is, explain that to them. What? Needful Things.
Needful Things. Yeah. I've never read the book or watched the movie. I know the synopsis, like the plot point of it basically is like, what is it? The devil owns this antique store in Maine, obviously, mm-hmm. to give the most sought after item that somebody wants. And then, you know, kind of like the monkey paw effect, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So that's where the name Macabre Emporium actually comes from. But with the biggest thing with our podcast is that we have what's called the Big Six. Jeffrey Dahmer, Ed Kemper, John Wayne Gacy, that's the one that I was going for, David Berkowitz, Ted Bundy, that's the name I was thinking of, and Richard Ramirez. that's what we consider the big six on our show. We will not do them. We are not covering them at all at any point. The only time they will be brought up in an episode is a point of reference. So if you're, it's like, we're not doing them because they're so overdone, there's no new information out there, we're going to learn. I mean, there's always an interpretation somebody else has of them, but there's how many true crime podcasts out there that already covered these guys? Everyone's, I guess you could say, going over the same information and then putting their interpretation on it. So with all those out there, we wanted to bring something different out there and like go over lesser known cases. Like, have you ever heard of the name Herbert William Mullins at all?
I have not, no.
He was a serial killer at the same time as Ed Kemper was out there. So, but for the most part, it's that we do each new section of our episode like you guys do. Sarah does mostly true crime. I do more like origins, weird history. It's like I'll see something like just out of the blue, it's just like, where did this come from? So for example, like that, first my episode on cemetery origins and the birthday origins, that was like two things that just popped in my head one day. It's like, how did this all become a thing?
Mm-hmm.
So I started looking into it. I would say the birthday origins one so far to date is the most difficult one that I had to do.
Because of all the little just because of how far back
of origins of things that came from each, you know, society, starting with the ancient Egyptians and then the Greeks and the Romans with the things that they do. And then every once in a while I get one of those really off the wall weird history things like the Great Dumpling War.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be
strange.
Or the 2-month ban on sliced bread during World War II.
Yeah, I remember that one.
And then I'll get these stories. It's like, I want to tell Sarah like right away, but she's like, no, don't tell me anything. Like, there's one that I have for Memorial Day that I plan on doing as a morale booster for troops. That's quite interesting because of what was dropped out of airplanes. And it's something you'll never suspect the, you know, U.S. military and the Allied forces to drop out of airplanes as a morale booster.
Condoms.
No. Something much larger and much heavier.
Condoms for elephants.
they're not dropping cases of Magnums out of airplanes.
Oh, hell no.
So, if you have a Cap Emporium, if you're looking for other things beside more during the week after you've caught up with on your current Dancy True Crime episodes, come check us out. Every Wednesday is when we release our episodes. Except for this coming Wednesday, we will not be having an episode due to plans we had put out ahead of time.
Yes.
And where all can our viewers find you guys then?
We are on all major platforms. We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere. If you search Macabre Emporium on Google, we are the first thing that actually comes up. We do have a website, macabreemporiumpodcast.com.
Yes.
And you'll be able to find links to where our show is available on there, as well as our RSS feed main page where a lot of those links are, and plus episodes if you use your own separate player.
Yeah, and we can put their link in our show notes as well.
Okay.
Thanks for letting us come on with you.
Yes, we definitely appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for joining us.
Of course.
And sometime in the future, we'll have to have you guys on our show for an episode like you have for us today.
Yes.
Awesome. That'd be very cool. Awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, once again, I am Daniel.
And I'm Casey.
And we've got, on the other side,
David and Sarah. We got them on there?
Yes.
Yep.
So, everybody have a good week, and we will see you next week.
And from us at Macabre Emporium, we would like to tell you to always
creep it real.
Bye. Hey guys, Casey here. I just wanted to remind you that if you want to see our research links or photos that we have, they will be posted on our Facebook page. They are posted at the same time as our podcast on Anchor and Spotify. That is every Monday at 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. So we hope to see you guys there. Hey guys, I just want to remind you to follow our Facebook page, join our group. It is Dancy True Crime. That is D-A-N-S-I True Crime. And also, you can hear us on Anchor or Spotify. Please rate us and subscribe or follow and share our episodes. message us on Facebook. Let us know what you think, what we could change, what we could do better. Do you have anything you want to add, babe?
No, I think you did it. You said it just perfect. So,
all right. Well, we hope you guys have a fantastic week and that you enjoy today's episode.
We'll see you next week, guys.
Bye.